Sarah Harding, a member of Girls Aloud and also an actress, died over the weekend, aged just 39, from breast cancer. She'd received her diagnosis in mid-2020. Joined on the line now by Aisling Hurley, Chief Executive of Breast Cancer Ireland. Aisling, you're very welcome to the programme.
Thanks a million, Ciara.
Sarah Harding's death has knocked a lot of people for six. She would have been very, very familiar face to particularly a lot of women of a certain age. And it really does show that cancer doesn't discriminate.
Absolutely. I mean, it's a tragic circumstance for somebody so young. Cancer doesn't discriminate regardless of your age. And I think a lot of people have the misconception that cancer will only affect older women, when in actual fact 30% of those under the age of 50 are diagnosed with cancer annually. So I mean, we have 3,700 new cases each year, and if you look at the statistics, 1 in 9 women will be diagnosed in their lifetime.
And what I don't think that we have here in Ireland is a really strong, robust culture of monthly self-checking.
Yeah, that is the most unfortunate thing. And it's one thing that I suppose pre-COVID and also during COVID for the last 18 months, Breast Cancer Ireland has really been trying to urge women to take control of their own breast health, you know, empowering them to understand what is good breast health, knowing, you know, what is normal, checking yourself on a monthly basis, knowing the signs and symptoms, and also how to perform a self-breast examination. We have a free to download app called BreastAware. It offers a monthly reminder to your phone, a little pink ribbon pops up. It also has a video guide on how to perform a self-breast examination, and it outlines the 8 signs and symptoms that women, and indeed men, should be aware of.
And can you talk us through those signs and symptoms, Aisling?
Sure, absolutely. So, for instance, a lot of people think that breast cancer is purely a lump. It's not always a lump. There are many other signs. It could be a puckering of the skin around the breast. It could be a lump in the breast or in the armpit. It could be a change in the skin around the nipple and maybe nipple discharge. Also dimpling of the nipple and nipple retraction. And dimpling, when I say dimpling, that's a little bit like orange peel or cellulite for all the world. And that, when you see something like that, that is the tumour on the inside pulling at the skin. Another sign would be an unusual increase in the size of one breast. Now, lots of people have breast sizes that one is bigger than the other, especially around the time of the month. But what we would recommend is that people do their monthly check maybe 7 days after their period has finished. Another would be that one breast would be significantly or unusually lower than the other. In other words, the nipples are not aligned. There's an enlargement of glands around the breast area. And remember, the breast area is not just the breast itself. It travels right up to the collarbone and in around your back. So it is important to really check yourself thoroughly. And another would be a swelling under the armpit.
Now, that is a lot of information to remember, but I suppose the essential point is, if anything looks unusual, if you can't remember all of those signs or symptoms, if it appears to you to be unusual, if you get that strange little feeling in the pit of your stomach when you touch that point, that little something's not quite right here, don't put it on the back burner.
That's the most important thing. And the thing is, you start today with sort of your baseline, and this is your normal. And then each month as you check, if that baseline changes in any way, that's when you need to be proactive. Contact your GP. Your GP will assess you based on a severity of risk. So whether you're low risk, medium risk or high risk, based on what he or she checks. And then they will refer you to the consultants in the breast clinic. They too will triage you according to risk. And based on high risk, you'll be seen within 2 weeks. Medium and lower risk will be pushed out maybe by 4 weeks or 6 weeks. But the most important thing to remember is the clinics are working. They are, if nothing else, COVID has given them a super efficiency and a super safety standard. So no longer is there 60 people waiting in a waiting room to be seen, hours delayed with consultants. You're given a prescribed time. You come to the car park, the breast nurse calls you. As one patient leaves, you're brought in. You're examined, you're discussed, you maybe go through a triple assessment, and as soon as you're done, you're gone. So it is very, very much more efficient.
And I know you touched on this slightly, but men can also develop breast cancer. It's certainly a much more rare experience, but it's not vanishingly rare.
No, it's not. I mean, if you look at the statistics of 3,700 new cases annually, one in 1,000 men, that's 37 men are diagnosed with breast cancer. We currently have a breast cancer ambassador because we launched Great Pink Run today, and he is very much at the forefront of that, where he was diagnosed a couple of months ago, went for a run, came home, had a shower, noticed a little bit of a lump, thought nothing of it. 2 weeks passed, noticed it still there, went to his GP. Again, GP thought perhaps it's a cyst, but decided to send him on to the matter to just be checked properly. It turns out he did have breast cancer and has had a full mastectomy since and is recovering.
I wanted to ask you about a slightly related topic, and this would just be your own personal opinion. Following Sarah Harding's death, there's been a lot of discussion and debate online about the language used around death, particularly by cancer. It's often characterised as someone having lost a battle, and many people seem to be of the view that that unfairly attributes blame to the person who has not survived cancer. Do you have a view or an opinion on that, Aisling?
I too agree. I think that, you know, these people are faced with such an enormous challenge, and, you know, they do everything in their power and within their power to overcome it and, you know, take all the treatment that's necessary. I don't think it's that they've lost the battle. You know, I think of it, I mean, I look and I meet so many metastatic disease patients similar to Sarah Harding, where new clinical trials are every day being discovered. And it's something that we at Breast Cancer Ireland invest hugely into, is metastatic disease progression, because it's the most challenging. That is, just so that people understand, is where an initial breast cancer diagnosis and treatment has taken place, but that the tumour, some small cells of the cancer have evaded that treatment, have hidden and have gone and invaded the major organs like the lungs, the liver, the spine, and could ultimately be the brain. So this is the part that we hugely need to do more research and need to continue investing in, because ultimately our end game is we want to transform this disease into a treatable long-term illness.
Aisling Hurlig, Chief Executive of Breast Cancer Ireland, thank you indeed for joining us. And you can find out all of that organisation's resources and information on breastcancerireland.com. And I just wanted to revisit for a moment a piece that I know Clem referenced on this morning's edition of Kildare Today. And that is a piece by Donal Lynch in today's Irish Independent, I believe. And it is the story of Darragh McDonagh, who was a 59-year-old man who was himself diagnosed with breast cancer, and he found a lump on his chest, and he said cancer was the last thing on his mind. And he said in the waiting room last year, he clocked the glances he was getting from the dozen or so women who were sitting near to him. He says there was some nervous shifting. A couple of them crossed their arms protectively across their chest. And by the time, he says, he was called, he was sitting on his own. Everyone was over the other side of the room. Most of them, he supposed, were wondering what a man on his own was doing at a breast cancer screening clinic. And he says, and to be fair, I was wondering that myself. He says, at that stage, breast cancer was not in my head. He was subsequently diagnosed with breast cancer and underwent a biopsy and a mammogram. And then when the results came back, the news was broken to him. And he says he felt as if the relevant professor, Professor Stokes, told him that he was pregnant or something. I thought, this guy is away in the head. I was just in shock. I still can't believe that this is happening. Darragh required surgery to remove the cancerous lump. And certainly salutary tale for us all to pay attention to our bodies. TUSLA, the Child and Family Agency, has launched a new campaign today looking for carers for children who are seeking international protection in Ireland. I'm joined on the line now by Kate Duggan. She's Director of Services and Integration at TUSLA. Kate, you're very welcome to the programme.
Good afternoon, Ciara.
Now, TUSLA is part of the mission to assist the European Union relief efforts to help children in migration and provide them with a safety and with shelter. How many young people have arrived into Ireland unaccompanied in recent months?
So, Ciara, the government committed in September 2018 as part of that European programme that you referenced to transition 36 children and young people seeking international protection into Ireland. So far, 8 of those children and young people arrived back in June 2020, 13 then arrived in July of this year, 6 in late August, and then we have 9 children and young people due to arrive in September, later this month. And they are children who have come from the Moira camp in Greece. Your listeners may remember the fire that was covered in the media there back at that time. They are children who originate from Afghanistan, from Syria, from Eritrea, from Iran, from Pakistan. And also then what we have is we have some young people, usually older teenagers, who also arrive into Ireland as unaccompanied minors who, you know, turn up just at the ports and airports, who are seeking international protection.
And you're looking for people to share their home with these young people. What kind of household setup are you looking for? Would you like people from a diversity of backgrounds, a diversity of age groups and life experiences?
All of those things, Ciara. This is, you know, many of your listeners will be familiar with fostering in Ireland. So this is where we are launching a dedicated campaign for fosterers, for those children seeking international protection. And the reason it's a dedicated campaign is that we have had contact from members of the public who may not have considered fostering in the past, but who now want to be part of a humanitarian response to help these children who've suffered in many ways. So we are looking for the same type of foster carers. We're looking for individuals, for families who are available and want to provide a caring and a nurturing and a supportive environment to children and young people. Certainly, we want people who are open to different backgrounds, to different cultural, different religious, different linguistic backgrounds, because of the diversity of children that do come into care. But one of the important messages I want to get out there today is that we are seeking foster carers, as I said, individuals or families from lots of different ethnic, religious backgrounds, people who are in heterosexual or same-sexual relationships, perhaps people who are renting rather than owning a home, because there often have been many myths out in public in terms of the type of individuals or families that can foster. There's a robust fostering process, because we have to make sure, you know, that these people are appropriate and, you know, that these young people are going to be placed in a safe environment. But we do want to work with a range of individuals from a diverse background.
I think that particular point about being a renter or homeowner is a really important one, because I think that there's been a myth doing the rounds that you can only foster or perhaps engage with this particular programme, Kate, if you are a homeowner. And if that were the case, that would rule out some 12,000 households in this county alone.
And that's not the case. And what I would say is we have a free phone number at the moment, 1800-226-771. Or if you go onto the TUCSA website, all of the details are up there. And if you're any way motivated by this campaign or by fostering in general, I would ask individuals and members of the public to make contact with that number. And any of the questions or queries they might have about their own personal circumstance, that they discuss that with the staff member who take their call, and they can be talked through then what the process does involve, because it is a robust process, because obviously we have to make sure that the children and young people that we place in state care are safe. So it includes Garda vetting and it does include a robust assessment of their capacity to provide a safe and nurturing environment.
Now, I would imagine that there's a certain element of time critical to this, because some of these children and young people are already in Ireland. Some will be arriving very shortly. So I would imagine, Kate, you would advise anybody who feels strongly motivated listening to you and I have this conversation not to delay in getting in touch.
Absolutely. We'd be delighted if people got in touch as soon as possible. It still is a robust process, an assessment process, and we are committed to making sure that that happens. So any of these children coming to Ireland that have come, obviously, or those that are coming in late September, have an identified place to stay. And that may be in a small residential unit initially. And so then once the assessment would be complete, we could transition them into the family home environment. But also, we know that the government and with our colleagues in the Department of Justice are going to commit to another programme as part of the European Wide Commission for Response. So that probably will happen into either late 2021 or into 2022. So this program and this campaign is about building capacity within the system to meet that need, not just in 2021, but right into 2022.
Well, Kate Duggan, Director of Services and Integration at TUSLA, thank you indeed for joining us. And that number again is 1800 226 771, 1800 226 771, or you can email tusla.fostering@tusla.ie for more information. If any parent spends most of the day singing songs from Barney or Dora, we'll know how powerful a tool for learning cartoons are. And I'm joined on the line now by two people who are going to use an Irish animation series, a brand new Irish animation series, to teach children about online safety and empathy. Andrew Kavanagh is CEO of Cavalier, and Philip Arneil is Head of Education and Innovation. You're both very welcome to the programme.
Thanks, Ciara.
Thank you.
Andrew, we'll start with you first. Tell us a little about Alva's World and how it begun, its genesis.
Well, I've got two kids, and in my late 40s, and I didn't grow up with the internet. So the way my brain works is I tried to come up with cartoons that I think, you know, are going to be as useful to the parents as they are to the kids. So at the time I was developing this a couple of years ago, I knew that there was a big issue with children being bullied online, and, you know, with, you know, people stealing identity and using anonymity in ways that would affect children. Mm. And I didn't know how to react to that as a parent. So so I made this cartoon as much for myself as for my kids.
And through that process, I mean, you clearly learned an awful lot.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, I would be a digital dunce in many ways. You know, I've gotten past having my password as 12345, that kind of thing. But I wouldn't be the most technically savvy person. And I think for me, my kids are a little bit older now, but they're still, thankfully, you know, not, apart from Nintendo, they're not really online too much. Mm. But I wanted to, I watch cartoons with my kids, so I think it's a great discussion point. I mean, you could sit down and watch a cartoon and discuss what's happening in the episode with them. So hopefully this show, you know, provides that tool for parents and kids.
And Andrew, tell us a little about Alva and who she is.
So Alva's an 8-year-old girl who lives in a typical Irish family, played by Lucy O'Connell in the cartoon. And yeah, it's a digitally connected household. And I think when we'd started, it was, you know, COVID hadn't quite hit yet. We just started the animation, and we were then producing the whole show during the first lockdown. So it was a time when kids were online all the time. So, you know, we were able to explore, you know, typical family scenarios. Like, we, you know, the homeschooling was going on. Contact tracing was a new buzz term that we were hearing about. But, you know, the ordinary stuff like online gaming, you know, just sharing information on social media and all those kind of things all happen in the home. Mm. So she's the middle kid. She's got an older sister who's 13, Nessa, and Nessa's online all the time, phone in the hand constantly. And then she's got the younger brother, Finn, who's on his tablet and, you know, just mashing the hand against the screen. So she has some info, but not all the info. So she's learning as she goes.
Philip, you're Head of Education and Innovation. I mean, I mentioned at the outset what a powerful educational and entertainment tool cartoons can be for children. You've collaborated in the development of this with CyberSafe Kids.
Yeah, so I'm the Head of Education at CyberSafe Kids. So we've been consulting on the messaging with Cavalier and Andrew at the helm, and it's been a fantastic opportunity for us because I think it's the animation series in itself is a wonderful way to connect directly with kids and parents, obviously, in a medium that's very popular with kids, but also just by, you know, sharing those story outlines. And then I would give some comments and some ideas that hopefully then would feed into the story before it was produced. It was a fantastic way for us to kind of get our message across and also help Cavalier develop those kind of online messages, because obviously we're working with kids all the time in schools and working with the parents too. And so we're familiar with a lot of these areas that Alva's dealing with in terms of, you know, being safe online, being responsible online, and even then more general things just like, you know, the etiquette of how you should behave in certain ways, or, you know, spending limits when you're on different apps and those kind of games as well. So it's been a wonderful opportunity for us to collaborate.
And it really is an empowerment tool, because if children see characters their own age in a household that looks pretty much fairly similar to theirs, making good choices or learning how to make good choices, that has a great positive influence.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, of course, I think, you know, kids are going to respond better to anything that's coming from their peers than it is from adults telling them what to do. I mean, I think that's proven over time for sure. And I think, you know, empowerment really is the key word. That's something that's part of our mission statement. And in CyberSafe Kids, we very much believe that, you know, it's not about always highlighting the negatives of being online. It's not about sort of, you know, calling for this to be banned or that to be banned, but actually it's about looking at the positives of being online and really finding that balance for kids and for parents between understanding what the harms and risks are. And of course, those are there in the online world, but also looking at the positive experience. And if we've ever seen that, surely it's in the last 18 months where, you know, kids and families were able to connect with each other online. In lockdown, they were able to continue schooling. They were able to work on different projects together. We had all these kind of viral phenomenons and family quizzes and all these kind of things. So it's a positive and empowering place. And as long as you understand the risks and the areas that you can fall into harm, then I think that's really the important message. And that's definitely the message that comes across from the stories in ALVA.
Andrew, what do your kids think of ALVA?
Well, actually, they're going to see it today for the first time.
Oh, have they not seen it?
No, I don't. I'm one of these guys who, you know, I have to wait till it's finished. So my youngest has just come in the door, and my eldest boy is finishing up soon. So we're going to sit down at 6:25 this evening and watch the first episode.
Oh, that's going to be so exciting for you.
Yeah, they're a little, like, I have an 8-year-old, so he's bang on the audience and, you know, asking all those questions that Alba is encountering in the episode. So I'm delighted. My eldest boy is 12. He knows everything already. But we're going to sit down as a family and watch the first step tonight. So.
Well, enjoy it. The world premiere of Alva's World, created by Andrew Kavanagh, CEO of Cavalier, and of course, very strongly contributed to by CyberSafe Ireland. And we were joined there by Philip Arneil, CyberSafe Kids, Head of Education and Innovation. And you can watch Alva's World on RTE Junior from 6:25 tonight, and it'll also be broadcast on Sky Kids from October 18th. I know a lot of households around County Kildare are anxiously awaiting the release of the first round CAO offers tomorrow. But also this week, there's another keynote date, and it is the deadline for applications to 3 Kildare education bursaries. And the deadline for applications is 5 o'clock this Friday. And the bursaries are the William G. Carroll Bursary for Community. It's mainly for, but not exclusively, for students undertaking courses in the area of community development. The Kildare Education Bursary for People with Disabilities. That's for anyone living with a disability studying any third level course. And the Kildare County Council Memorial Bursary for DESH School students. The bursary is for any third level student who previously attended a DESH school. You can find all of the details either on the local news section of kfmradio.com or Kildare County Council's website. Now, as and from today, you can put soft plastics into your domestic recycling bin. To discuss this, I'm joined on the line now by Seamus Clancy. He's Chief Executive of Repack. Seamus, you're very welcome to the programme.
Good afternoon, Ciara.
I have a sneaking suspicion that many of us were doing this anyway and we shouldn't have been.
There probably was a little bit of that, okay, Ciara, but I suppose today is really a very significant step change in the recycling of waste plastic packaging in Ireland. And that's all because it's a collaboration from quite a number of stakeholders, from the department to the waste industry to my waste.ie, Repack, and of course the consumer. And the consumer has been doing a great job, and that's the next step. So from today, we're asking all consumers to put both soft and plastic packaging in the recycling bin, to make sure it's clean, it's dry, and it's loose. So we want to recycle more and better. And also we want to bring an end to the confusion for the public on what can and can't go into the recycling bin. You know, for instance, you know, they say the wrapper on your toilet paper or the pasta bag or the kind of flimsy plastic. Yeah. They're what they call the soft plastics or lightweight plastics, LDPE, low-density polyethylene. And that's because there's been huge advances in the optical separation technology that can now identify these plastic polymers in the last few years. There's been huge investment in infrastructure by the waste industry in Ireland and Repack. We've put in an additional 10 million a year into that to support it. And all the ways along, you know, roughly half of all plastics are soft plastics, and they've been going for energy recovery, lost there. And a lot of them are really good plastics that can be recycled. So today is the big change in that, in making that difference and starting on the next step of the journey, really, to make Ireland far more self-sufficient and long-term environmentally sustainable. Because along with the consumer who have really embraced the whole environmental agenda, it has also meant that, you know, producers of packaging, they now have to design packaging that requires all plastics to be recyclable by 2030. So this is a journey, and those that don't do that will end up having to take fairly punitive charges under what we call eco-fee modulation. In other words, if it's recyclable, you would pay a less fee, but if it's not recyclable or difficult to recycle, you'd be paying a substantially higher fee for the packaging you place in the market. So like, I suppose that's the background.
And today's change, I understand, Seamus, and please correct me if I'm wrong, has been enabled by the development of new technology, which means that you can effectively detect the softer plastics, lump them all together.
Yes, absolutely. There's two parts of this. And but also, please remember all the time, it has to be clean, it has to be dry, it has to be loose. It's pointless putting all your plastics into a black plastic bag that then has to be broken up to then try and separate everything after it. So we're really saying make sure it's clean, dry and loose. So the detectability of everything now is based on the technology that can detect the different plastics using optical separators. That's using infrared light. And the second one then is through air separation of density. And it still requires, at the end of all this, there will also be some hand separation as well on very big items. But that is where the technology is going. So, as I said, this is a journey, and we expect to see more significant changes in technology in the next few years.
And that continued requirement for clean is really important. And I would imagine, Seamus, it more or less rules out cling film.
Well, yes, I'll tell you, if cling film is wrapped around food, then look, logic prevails in the sense, you know, you don't put that in, you just wrap it and put it in the general bin. But if it's clean cling film that's been used on, say, fruit or something like that, that isn't contaminated, then it can be wrapped in a ball and put in the recycling bin. That actually can be recycled. But again, it comes back to, if it is used to wrap food and it isn't clean, please don't put it in there.
I know that recycled material is supposed to be dry, and I also know that a lot of people don't have recycling bins, they have recycling bags, which might live outside. Does that mean then that those items cannot be recycled if, let's say, they get rained on?
Well, first and foremost, the waste industry in Ireland have a legal obligation to provide every household with a bin if they so want it. Now, not everybody has the position to have a bin, but in the main, the majority of people do. So if you have a recycled bag, again, if you're going to be putting out, please make sure, you know, that it is sealed and you don't get water or anything into it. Otherwise, any of those materials can no longer be recycled. In the main, though, I think the majority, I think roughly 1.8 million households have recycling bins now. And I would encourage the public, if you haven't a recycling bin from your waste operator, please ask them for one.
And Seamus, have we seen much of an evolution in recent years in recycling rates per household here in Ireland?
Well, we are, first and foremost, year on year, we continue to recycle more tonnages, but we also are generating more each year. So we have to get that balance right. We have to try and make sure we eliminate unnecessary packaging, and that's a producer responsibility, but it's also a consumer to ask more questions. We have a big program of reduction as well for plastic producers. That's working well. We have 140 the main plastic producers in the country that represent over 80% of plastic that goes in the market. And they've all signed up to the Repack Plastic Pledge. And that's working well, where they are taking it very seriously. I'll give a good example. If you go into your supermarket today and you'll find the majority of, say, you're buying cherry tomatoes or something like that, they will now be in a paper tray and with a film that's over it. That film is totally recycled, but so is the paper tray. So you can see already the movement away from plastic, where it can be replaced with something that's as sustainable or more sustainable.
Seamus, where are we falling down? Are there areas in which we're not being as innovative as we could be?
Well, I think there's probably two parts to that. First and foremost, because we have economies of scale issues in Ireland, we don't have the necessary infrastructure to be able to process materials in Ireland. And secondly, I suppose it's the core issue all the time. We have to continuously educate the public. This is a marathon, not a sprint. And behaviours change all the time. And we are seeing different cohorts that are very strong in recycling, and then we're seeing other cohorts that are not as conscious of the recycling. So I think it's a constant education process that we need to do more and more and more of all the time.
Well, Seamus Clancy, Chief Executive of Repack, thank you indeed for joining us. So from today, you no longer have to bin those soft plastics. You can put them into your recycling bin.